Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good evening, everyone. My name's Ed Cox. I am Director for People, Power and Place here at the RSA, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here for this special event. Tonight's event is part of a season to mark the opening of the RSA's new Enlightenment Coffee House downstairs, Rothmells, a space for everybody who wants to share ideas and work together to make positive social change a practical reality. We're hearing from change makers and creative minds on the big social and political and economic challenges that we face and the roles for state and society in confronting these issues that lead to practical change. In many areas of the world, liberal democracy is in crisis, with increasing evidence of declining support and an openness to more populist or authoritarian governance. Anybody that's attended some of the events in this great room or listened to RSA podcasts will be familiar with many of these issues. The crisis in liberal democracy is one of the defining issues of our times. In his annual lecture this year, the RSA Chief Executive, Matthew Taylor, drew attention to the growing use of public deliberation, citizens' juries, citizens' assemblies, and the like, in countries all around the world as new democratic tools to unlock some of the complex issues that seem so intractable for more orthodox representative democratic systems. And Matthew called for a campaign for deliberative democracy to draw attention to its potential and ensure that it's much more widely used in the UK context. Plans for that campaign are developing. We've had a workshop this afternoon, and we're looking forward to making more announcements about this in the new year. But this evening, I'm delighted to welcome a leading thinker on the future of democracy and ways in which it can be revitalised. Our distinguished speaker this evening is Professor James Fishkin. James holds the Janet M. Peck Chair in International Communication at Stanford University. He's also director of the Centre for Deliberative Democracy, and he's written extensively about deliberative practices. James is going to talk about the ideas in his latest book, Democracy When the People Are Thinking. And he's going to argue that deliberative approaches can provide a practical solution to many of democracy's current ills. The format for this evening is that first we'll hear from James for about 25 minutes, and then I'll rejoin him on stage for a discussion. And we'll look forward to then hearing your thoughts. There'll be plenty of time for Q&A before we wrap up at about 7 o'clock. So now, if I might hand over to our distinguished speaker this evening, Professor James Fishkin.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Of all the introductions I've ever received, that is the most recent. But it's also very meaningful to me because this is an important, innovative organization going all the way back to the 18th century. And my own country attempts to be an innovative governmental organization, but hasn't been so, well, it's been innovative, but not what I would, it's been ever-changing, also going back to the 18th century. And I see many friends here, especially David Lloyd and Fiona Chesterton from Channel 4, who actually started this whole adventure. And I have one slide that I'm going to refer to. But they're the ones at Channel 4 who had the courage to launch deliberative polling. And deliberative polling was launched in the UK in 1994, before any of the other things that you referred to, the citizens' juries and the rest here. And I will argue for a certain model, and I see Graham Smith and Graham Allen, many people interested in deliberative democracy. Okay, so let me get to the point. So the question is, as as we just heard, democracy is in threat or under question. Approval ratings for democratic institutions are at historic lows around the world. Approval for politicians in many countries is the same as is worse than that for undertakers and for used car salesmen and the rest. But I have a different question. I'm interested in deliberation. Who deliberates about what should be done, right? And my own country, our democracy, which was not actually initially supposed to be a democracy, but a republic, where the representatives would deliberate, refining and enlarging the public views, as Madison said, on behalf of the public interest. But Madison didn't envision parties, political parties. And the competition between parties actually often undermines deliberation. So we can think of four types of democracy: competitive democracy, elite deliberation, which was what Madison wanted, mass participatory democracy, and then deliberative democracy by the people themselves, which is always invoked, but never actually, not much practiced, and often indeed interfered with. That is, every time somebody wins an election, they claim a mandate from the people. But the question is, what opportunity do people have to deliberate? The will of the people is invoked, but how is it formed when there is so much effort, hello Henry, there's so much effort by people to manipulate public opinion, and the whole liberal democratic aspiration that a speech will be answered by more speech is no longer working the way it was supposed to, as John Stuart Mill formulated it in On Liberty, for example, because misinformation is often not responded to because people are in their own filter bubbles. People are consorting with the like-minded, so they may never hear why something that's being said is completely off or made up or preposterous even. So if you look at these four kinds of democracy, then the question is, who is deliberating? Deliberative democracy by the people themselves is the one that I want to talk about an institutional design for. But in mass participatory democracy, you know, I come from California where we have referenda, ballot propositions, initiatives all the time. The campaign process, the television sound bites, the misleading ads are the same as for ordinary campaigns. Elite deliberation, you know, parties have whips, and representatives would like to deliberate, but they pay a cost. They get pushed to the back benches if they break from the party line. And competitive democracy, parties don't want to win the argument. They want to win the election, and that's natural. It's built into the structure. So the question is, how can we find appropriate designs for citizen deliberation that represent the public, that are thoughtful and evidence-based, and how can we find entry points where those deliberative processes can actually have an impact on decisions? And that's what I'm going to show you. So who deliberates? Well, we have a method which I call deliberative polling, which David and I started in 1994 in the UK, and I call it deliberative polling. And it's now been conducted in 28 countries, 109 cases, and I'm going to talk about criteria for evaluating it and why we should have confidence in it. But you can even see it's been done in African countries where the low literacy rate might make you think it's not possible. It is possible. Everywhere we go, the people are smart. You just have to give them a reason to think that their voice matters, and you have to have an operating system, if you will, that's accessible where they can understand the issues and weigh the competing arguments and come to thoughtful conclusions without the press of the social pressure to reach a consensus, where they can come to an informed judgment, and you need a way of harvesting those judgments. So the method that I've been using over the years is embarrassingly simple. It's meant to respond to three problems. First, rational ignorance, which any social scientist will recognize since Anthony Downs. If I have one vote in millions, why should I pay a lot of attention to complex issues of public policy? Because my individual vote or voice will not make much difference. Would that it were otherwise. But we all have things to do. We have jobs, families, et cetera, et cetera. So most people, most of the time, will not be deeply informed about public matters, public policy issues. And the survey evidence bears that out all around the world. So you have little incentive for people to think seriously, unfortunately. Secondly, what I call phantom opinions, Phil Converse at the University of Michigan, who first discovered it, called them non-attitudes. But many people don't actually have opinions, but they will answer a poll and offer opinions because they don't like to say they don't know. So my friend George Bishop at the University of Cincinnati famously questioned people about their views on the so-called Public Affairs Act of 1975. And the public had views about the Public Affairs Act of 1975, supporting it or opposing it, et cetera. But it didn't exist. There was no Public Affairs Act of 1975. And the Washington Post famously did polling about the repeal of the Public Affairs Act of 1975 on its 20th anniversary, and they got the same result. And then they said, then they told half the sample that the Republicans wanted to repeal it and half that the Democrats wanted to repeal it, and then they got different results based upon that, but it never existed, of course. And then there's this problem of the filter bubbles, where selectivity of sources, that if you do talk about politics or public policy, you talk to people like yourself. You talk to people who are your friends, your family, and they will tend to agree with you. And the filter bubbles, which my friend Eli Pariser posed the term, the Googles and the Facebooks will now automatically send you the things that you're likely to find agreeable. So you'll never hear the other side. And then our news sources will help us just select the right things that we want. So my simple question, the whole thing is embarrassingly simple. The method that I have is embarrassingly simple. The question that I have is embarrassingly simple. It is, what would the people think under good conditions for thinking about? What would they think? Not what do they think, what would they think? So it's a hypothetical. So then we have to get the people. We do that with rigorous random sampling, where we gather a microcosm, usually face-to-face, but also we do it online with video connections for the small group discussions. We gather a rigorous random sample, demonstrably representative in its attitudes and demographics, so we have other data to show that it's a microcosm of the viewpoints. This is what John Stuart Mill wanted the so-called Congress of Opinions to be, a microcosm of the viewpoints in society, where you could be confident that the force of the better argument was leading to the conclusion, not some that were arrived at, not some other force. That's in Considerations on Representative Government. Well, this was the, let me tell how it works, and this was the first one. So what we have come to do is there's some public issue. We then gather an advisory group that develops an agenda on that issue. Sometimes it's crowdsourced. I worked with Graham Smith sitting there on a project called Power 2010, where he was part of the crowdsourcing project. But normally, there's some issue that's consequential for decision-making, and somebody's going to have to decide, and public input is relevant to that. So then there's an advisory group representing the different points, the different perspectives on the issue. It could be cross-party, it could be some other specific policy issue where there are different viewpoints. You want all the viewpoints in the room on an advisory group to vet materials that will be the basis for discussion. So we know we can have an evidence-based discussion. We've taken to also, with television partners or media partners, producing a video version of the briefing materials as well for those who would find that more congenial. So you have an advisory group, you have vetted materials, Then we have a questionnaire. And the questionnaire is not only about what should be done, but about the explanatory variables that might explain why people think something is a good idea or why they think it's not a good idea. Okay, so we have the initial questionnaire, the initial survey. We bring the 300, 400, 500, 700 people, whatever the number is, to a single place. Sometimes it's online. Most often it's been face-to-face. We actually transport them. We bring them there. They gather together. They deliberate for a long weekend, typically. If the online ones have been like one full day, but usually a long weekend. So they randomly assigned to small groups, and in the small, a random sample randomly assigned is a random sample, so you have diversity in the small group. So that, I won't play anything, but that was the first one, and that it was about crime and what to do about it in Britain, where the people were gathered in Manchester. Several points about that. We interviewed 800 people, and 300 came. But we had all the opinions and demographics and everything of the 800 because they completed the questionnaire. Actually, a very high response rate, certainly by modern standards, but a very high response rate. But we're still getting high response rates in the way we do this. So not like an awful lot of things pass for being polls that are just pseudo-polls these days, but really good social science. And we could compare the 300 with the 500. In every one of their attitudes and in the demographics, no, very few, if any, statistically significant differences. And when there was the differences were very tiny. We had as good a sample of Britain in, or the United, no, we didn't have Northern Ireland in that case. A good a sample of Britain in one room as you could get. And you could see Britain in all of its diversity. Okay, so I learned two things from that. The first is that a woman came up to me on the evening. We had a party, and she was on the weekend in the Manchester television studio, and she was a spouse accompanying her husband. And we permitted that. She wasn't in the sample, but she could come along for the trip and observe. And she said that she wanted to thank me because in 30 years of marriage, her husband had never read a newspaper. But from the moment he was invited to come to this, he started to read every newspaper every day, she said, and he was going to be much more interesting to live with in retirement. So the reason that this has really stuck with me, and Graham has heard me tell this story before, but the reason this has really stuck with me is it showed that we overcame the incentives for rational ignorance. He thought his voice mattered. He was going to be on television. He was going to be in a small group of a dozen or 15 or so. And the whole thing was consequential. Tony Blair was one of the politicians who responded to questions, even at the and the broadcast was very well done. Second thing that stuck in my mind was, it was on crime, right? And there was, and I hadn't thought of this, but if you have a good sample of the British people, you'll have criminals in the sample. So in one group that I was watching, there was a car thief. He said he was a reformed car thief, but the point is that he brought the experience of he brought unique experience to the discussion, confirmed by, so the way the process works: small group discussions, plenary sessions, competing experts, small group discussions, plenary sessions, policymakers. This process, politicians, this process played out over the whole weekend. So the diversity of a random sample brings many intellectual resources to a question. And these people found it absolutely fascinating to be with each other in a very civil discussion. So that was the first test. I'm going to skip through a lot of things fast, but we did a bunch of projects in Texas for the Public Utility Commission on the seemingly boring issue of how Texas was going to get its electricity. And the upshot of that was the willingness of the public to pay more on their monthly utility bill, just a little bit more, for wind power meant that the commission and the state ended up making a series of decisions that led Texas, at the time, it was last among the 50 states in terms of the amount of wind power. And by 2007, it became number one, surpassing California. And so that data was crucial when the people really, representative samples deliberating about, you know, and I can discuss any of these questions at greater length. Now, this thing can scale. That's the Parliament building of the European Union. But those are the citizens of our European-wide random sample in the Parliament. And we've done this twice with a sample of all 27 countries. And they make a lot of sense. We had to have headphones and, you know, interpreting thing. And it was 22 languages. Actually, it was 21 because all the Irish wanted to speak English. But they could have spoken Gaelic. Japan, the government in 2011 faced this issue of whether to privatize the pension system. And in a lot of polls, the proposal to privatize was close to 70%. But my Japanese colleagues and I did this national deliberative poll, and when the people thought about the risks and benefits of putting their pensions in the stock market, support for it went down to 35%. But support for increasing taxes, the consumption tax, to make the pension system solvent, because, you know, Japan's getting very old, went up dramatically. And so that's what the government ended up doing. And I think if they had stuck with the proposal which they were about to implement, it would have been a big problem. The Japanese government also did this after the Fukushima crisis. Recently, South Korea used it, where they faced this big problem. President Moon was anti-nuclear. His campaign was anti-nuclear. He found that there were these two nuclear reactors partially constructed. And it was a difficult choice. Were they going to finish the construction? Or if they didn't, not only had hundreds of millions of dollars been spent on it, the equivalent, but also there would be effects on the electricity prices, and they'd have to import fossil fuels instead to make up the difference, or actually somehow the South Korean public to cut back with conservation on the energy consumption, and they were already trying to do that. So when the people deliberated, there was a movement of the undecideds. They did a national deliberative poll, and the president announced they were going to decide based upon the deliberative poll. And there was, by the end, 59.5% supported continuing the construction, to everybody's surprise, by the way. And now the Moon government is spreading deliberative democracy a lot in South Korea. This is one that I want to mention before my time runs out. So I've had an adventure in Mongolia. Mongolia is actually a competitive democracy ever since 1992. It has a private property market system. It has two main parties, and the results swing wildly back and forth between the two parties. And the mayor of Ulaanbaatar, the capital, which has half the population, came to see me, and he said, "We've got a tabloid newspaper, great polarization between the parties. They can barely talk to each other. We've got misinformation spread on social media. And we've got accusations of corruption. Have you ever heard of a democracy like that?" So I said, "Yes." And so he said, "What would you do about it?" "Well, let's try applying this deliberative democracy work on the model of the deliberative poll." So we did a great project for the city, and that led to a change in the law. There's now, as described in my book, a law on deliberative polling which requires that the parliament sponsor a national deliberative poll on proposals for a constitutional amendment before it's allowed to consider whether to pass an amendment. And we did that, and this is that's the government palace. That's a statue of Genghis Khan in the back there, overlooking everything, as he overlooks many things in Mongolia. I've now been to Mongolia quite a bit. And that is our sample, except the first row is an advisory group. The guy in red is the chief monk, who's a very thoughtful All kinds of distinguished people in the society were involved in this. And there were a whole bunch of different proposals, and each of the two main parties had favorite proposals that went way down in the deliberation. One of them wanted to indirect rather than directly elect the president, because the other party was, because the party was convinced that, that the president was too powerful. That didn't work. One of them wanted a second chamber, but on the model of an earlier constitution where the second chamber is a carbon copy of the first chamber in terms of its party composition. And the people saw through that because they realized this, if you want to have a second chamber, it should be a check on the other chamber. And if the parties are identical in the two chambers, it won't work. So that one went way down. But there were a whole bunch of proposals to have an independent civil service, to have an independent judiciary, to fight corruption in various ways. And both parties seemed to agree on that. And those proposals all rose or ended up at 90% support. So those are being fashioned into an amendment now, which is being considered right now by the parliament. So I don't know how it will come out, because they have a special session where they're meeting. I'm hoping it will pass. I should tell you one of the proposals, which I was totally flabbergasted by when I heard it. It was to put the names of the ministries in the Constitution. Why would you do that, I asked. And the reason was, there's been a practice when a different party wins the election, they change the names of the ministries, and then they fire all the civil servants. Because the ministry of X no longer exists, now it's the ministry of Y. And so then that prevents them from having a professional civil service, which is something that the people really wanted. So I'm sure there are a number of different solutions to that that could be devised, but this one will work, and that's one of the points in the constitutional amendment. So, that's about 700 people. And by the way, almost everybody who was contacted took the initial survey. The National Statistical Office, who do the census, did the survey. Almost everybody took the survey. And almost everybody came. I think 690 out of 735 came for the three-day weekend in Ulaanbaatar. And, you know, Mongolia is big. It's the same size as Western Europe. So they had to come a long distance. And we had a separate sample that was never invited for comparison purposes. So it's a rigorous process, and I hope the amendment goes through. And how much time do I have?
Just a couple of minutes.
Okay. So I thought I invented all of this, but as many of you in this room know, the basic idea goes back to ancient Athens. That's a photo I took in the Museum of the Forum of the Clarotarian, the random sampling machine that the Athenians used to select the Council of 500 who selected the agenda for the assembly. And the council was actually, because it alternated with groups of 50, and there was a lot of small group discussion, according to my colleague Josh Ober, who's written a great book on the council, it was a deliberative institution. And I can't explain in any short sentence how this machine works, but you can look it up. It's called Clarotarian. So we took this back to Athens. That's George Papandreou there, and we started to use it to actually select candidates. And if he hadn't been swamped by the financial crisis, we had a whole agenda of work there. So one of the newspapers, I think maybe the Financial Times, but I'm not sure, wrote it up as Athenian democracy returns after 2,400 years. And we used it actually for candidates, but not for the selection of candidates, but just to have a dialogue with candidates in 1996. And we're going to do something like that in the U.S. to this coming year before the Iowa caucuses, but I'm not making an announcement. So you have to think about, in my view, in order to credibly speak for the people, particularly when you're actually making decisions, as in Japan, as in Texas, as in Mongolia, as in South Korea, you need to have a representative sample, representative in its viewpoints, as Mill pointed out, as well as its demographics. The opinion changes are not a criterion of quality, but Because sometimes people, after they hear all the arguments, will come out the same way. And it's a different kind of opinion because it's been tested against adverse views. But if you never got opinion change, then nobody would go to all this trouble. Actually, about two-thirds of the time, we get significant opinion change. Information gain, we measure that. Avoiding distortions, we're able to show in all the small groups that the groups are not dominated by the more advantaged. They're not dominated by the men. They're not dominated by the rich. They're not dominated by one racial or ethnic group compared to another. The discussions are very equal, and the opinion movements do not move in favor, in the direction of the more advantaged. We've studied that systematically in thousands of small groups. So that's avoiding the distortions. Impact on policy is great, although sometimes it's just a media project, but sometimes it actually is consequential for the voice of the people having an impact. And we also find it makes for better citizens. That is, it makes the moderated discussion with diverse others, the experience gives people a sense of greater efficacy. It leads them to be more involved. So there are benefits. So that's my last, I'm on my last slide. And this is where you might think I'm completely crazy. When I went to see David Lloyd decades ago, I was afraid, you know, he might think it was a crazy idea, and he didn't, thank goodness. But when, so I've got one more crazy idea. So my idea is, Bruce Ackerman and I wrote a book called Deliberation Day, where for big things like an election or something, you should have masses of people deliberating in the same way. But to do it face-to-face is very expensive, organizing and the rest of it. So my thought is, since we do very high-quality online deliberative pollings where you can see everybody in the small group, see all those people in that group there? This is our software. One person happens to be talking. But to scale it, we could use social media. We have an algorithm that will sort people of different political parties, viewpoints, ages, demographics, assign them to the same small groups. What is really crazy, or you might think is crazy until you think about it, is I've been wanting to develop an automated moderator that is using a little bit of AI, but mostly tapping the collective intelligence of the group for the people to have a deliberation. And we now have it because we got a National Science Foundation grant, and the computer scientists at Stanford developed it with us, and it works. And it even, I have to say, we've been testing it in classes, right? So last week we tested it in our class. It worked great. And the questions from the automated moderator in an in-class deliberative poll were just as good as with human moderators. So one of the things we have is a toxicity index for people insulting each other, because the idea is to have a civil discussion. So the Stanford students were so civil, there was no occasion for so we tested it among ourselves, and we role-played pretending to insult each other, and it worked perfectly in cutting off the discussion or bringing that as an issue for the group to decide, is so-and-so being uncivil? Which is something we'll need if we bring this to scale. So my idea is we're now testing in controlled experiments human moderators and this automated moderator, which has a voice. It's the voice of my deputy, Dr. Alice Hsu, who's from my center. She has a nice voice. It controls the speaking cue, and make sure that everybody speaks. If somebody's not speaking, it sends them a reminder, would you like to contribute to this issue? If the issues only on one side are being discussed and not the other, it prompts to say, well, what would people on the other side say? It works very well so far, and it even organizes it to ask a question. Because the small groups ask group questions, And so my plan is to have group questions posed to the campaigns, which the answers will be posted on the web, and if the candidate themselves answered, they'll be posted on YouTube or something. So that's a plan in the works, but I'm looking for partners in various countries. We're now going to test it in Japan and in South Korea, and who knows, we might get to test it in the UK at some point. But the idea is to scale deliberation, but note, that is not a random sample. The only results that we present are from a random sample, because the random sample is consequential in that it represents the people and answers my hypothetical. What would the people think under good conditions for thinking about it? But the rest of the people should be part of the discussion and can see the force of the arguments on either side if they actually deliberate. It's much better than what my friend Bernard Manin in Paris calls audience democracy. Audience democracy, television and audiences are great, right? But we need to move citizenship beyond a spectator sport where people are actually participating. We need to do that at the micro scale, either with deliberative polling or something like it. And we need to do it at the macro scale with a more serious public discussion where people actually talk in a civil way to those they disagree with. So I'll stop there.
Well, Jim, thanks so much for that. Really inspiring to hear about the different experiments that are being used around the world and the development, if you like, of the techniques that you've been developing. I guess I'd like to take the conversation right back to the beginning. You're somebody that's been working in this field for a long time, but there is a genuine sense in this country, and we look at what's disintegrating down the road here, that deliberative democracy has a particularly special moment right now. Mm-hmm. That something, the reason we've got so many people here wanting to hear about how it might work is because we have this legitimacy crisis within democratic systems that feels all the more acute in the past 12 months, 18 months or so. I just wondered what your reflections were about that situation and the extent to which, for somebody like you who's been in it for the long haul, whether you're excited or concerned or challenged by the immediate context that we're in.
Sure. Well, you started the discussion today with the contrast between, with the problem of populism, mm-hmm. The angry voices of populism. I mean, this was goes right back to the American founding, where our founders were concerned about Shays' rebellion and the mob, and how could they get a thoughtful voice that somehow spoke for the people? They wanted to do it through the filtration of opinion through representatives. So it's a long-standing problem. I think that we have. The problem's even worse in the sense that there are non-democratic alternatives that might seem appropriate. After all, I've been to Singapore. Singapore is not a democracy. It doesn't really purport to be a democracy, but it has some of the best, most competent technocrats making decisions. They're all trained in my country at the Kennedy School, and they make good decisions, but they're not listening to the people. They're technocratic decisions. And the so-called, there's all this discussion now about the so-called China model, where meritocratic decisions in a non-democratic way will make decisions in the people's interests. So you have benign dictatorship or a benign technocracy, non-democratic. Then you've got our institutions of competitive democracy, and as I say, the division, hyperpolarization, willingness to do most anything to win, and I'm not making a comment about the UK, I'm talking worldwide, leads to a lack of legitimacy. And then you've got the mobilization of angry voices by populists who sees direct democracy, referendums, mobilizations of the public to express their anger, but not in this thoughtful, evidence-based way. So I see the deliberative democracy efforts as providing a middle ground that is a voice of the people, but thoughtful and representative. And the great thing that is lacking is thoughtful public will formation. And so I think if we can insert that where it's consequential and then properly express the reasons why people come to a view that they do and the arguments that are invoked that will have a purchase on public opinion. So that's why I think the moment for deliberative democracy is at hand.
And I suspect that you'll have many people in this room who would share that view, but I think the risk here, and I'm interested to get your take on this, is that it is very easy for those populists, for those angry voices, to play back to people like you or the RSA that this is another very technocratic form of governance. It seems highly complicated. It seems that we have to do quite a lot of work in terms of institutional design to make it happen. And so I just wonder whether there's a risk that actually others will just reach for the referendum because this process seems so much more complex.
Oh, there might be that risk, but look, every institutional... Democracy always requires an institutional design. I mean, even if you hold a referendum, it has to have a certain institutional design to make sure the votes are counted and people in theory have access to competing arguments. Why not have an institutional design that will increase the deliberation, the thoughtfulness, the good information that people have on either side, and that provides a representative public voice? So all of our democratic, of course, it's complicated. The easiest thing to want to know what the people think is just to ask them. But if you ask them in an ordinary poll, and polling is itself an institutional design, you ask them in an ordinary poll, you're going to get the kind of unreflective sound bites you may get the Public Affairs Act of 1975, for all you know. Now, if you ask them, if you just convene a meeting. You will. By the way, the Japanese, before they did our Fukushima deliberative poll, they had meetings around the country, and they had anti-nuclear activists showing up, yelling at electricity company employees who were paid to show up and yell on the other side. And this became a kind of circus all across the country, these public meetings, which were dominated by activists and self-selected people who were, and the rest of the public was left out. And then they did online consultation, and they think it was done by the same people who were yelling at each other online. And then they did ordinary polling, and the ordinary polling, they could never tell whether the people even understood the issues or thought about, because these energy choice issues are complicated. And then they did a national deliberative poll, and then the cabinet at the time in the DPJ government accepted the results of the deliberative poll. Seems to me it's positioned in a way, if you just get ordinary mobilized groups, who knows what they represent? Sure. They may even represent organized interests that are...
But the Japanese example leads me to the second question that I wanted to ask you, which is about, and this is in the context of us here in the UK wanting to develop a campaign to try and push deliberative democracy up the political agenda. What is it that enabled the Japanese government or the Korean government or the government of Texas to choose to want to commission and get involved with a deliberative poll in the way in which you've described? Is there anything that we can learn for that, for the work that we'd like to see happen in the UK?
Those are interesting cases, and they're very different, but it's a question of what are the alternatives. In the Texas case, all the state legislature passed was the idea that they had to consult the public in some way. And then since there are hundreds of millions of dollars at risk for these decisions, the companies said, well, if we do ordinary polling, the public won't understand. If we do have open meetings, it'll be controlled by lobbyists who will mobilize and show up or other organized interests. And so then they saw this deliberative poll we did on national television, and they came to see me. Right. So in Japan, they actually did these other things, and they saw they weren't getting anything useful, but the whole thing was so hot, they better have some sense of what the public would, because it was a dilemma.
Yeah.
And in South Korea, President Moon faced a real dilemma because he'd taken one position, but there seemed to be lots of arguments for doing the other, and so he needed to have a way of invoking the will of the people to do it.
What's interesting is the level of awareness amongst the political class in either of those two cases that they could turn to a deliberative process in order to address some of their challenges and difficulties.
Whereas
in this country, we seem to lack that kind of awareness as to how we deal with some of the most difficult and complex challenges. I want to open it up now to questions from the audience. I'm looking to get a diverse and representative sample of people as far as I possibly can, and I'm going to take questions in twos and threes. So there's a woman over in the corner. Could we go to her first? And keep your questions really nice and short, please, if you don't mind.
Hello, thank you so much. I'm really sort of in love with this approach, and I think it's really exciting. The one thing that I can't quite get my head around is the process of facilitation. So if you're thinking about being representative and the people being representative, how do you make sure that the information given is representative, and how do you get fair facilitation?
Great, that's good. And then there's a guy just two rows in front. Yes, please.
Hi. In terms of your evaluation criteria, I tried to match it up with a criteria that I used in the past, which was by Smith, 2009 was the paper, and I didn't see Trent. Okay, all right. We'll say hi later. I didn't see transparency. So one of his criteria was transparency in terms of the general public can see transparently that this is a fair process, and how did you address that?
Sure, fantastic. And then I think there's another question there. Yeah, this woman just there, please.
I've noticed in the examples you've given us that the more specific the issue, the more likely there will be a good outcome, in the sense that the people will take in the issues and be able to decide. Now, can you tell us whether you agree with that or whether deliberative polling could be used when there is a big, broad-based issue, like, say, just as an example, membership of the EEA? And if that's not appropriate, where do you draw the line? And can you give us an example of a broader deliberative poll which hasn't really succeeded?
Great, thank you. Let's just get some replies to those questions then, please.
Okay.
So, facilitation, transparency.
Yeah, yeah. So we always, the facilitators, we always train them in mock deliberation for a whole day, never to give any hint of their own opinion, but to facilitate a mutually civil, respected, a discussion with mutual respect where everyone roughly participates. And we've actually studied the talking time of different groups, men, women, highly educated, and even down to the number of words, because we often record the sessions and we have the transcripts. So we've studied this in great detail, and our facilitators are, when properly trained, and we usually spend a whole day in mock deliberation to do that, we don't want them offering their own expertise. We did a national deliberative poll in Australia on the Republic, that is, whether they would no longer recognize the Queen. And you might remember that before the national referendum, we did a nationally televised deliberative poll then. And initially, they provided me with moderators who were law professors. And I asked these law professors, can you manage these discussions without giving any hint of your own expertise on the issue? And they all said no. So I said, good, you've been promoted to be observers. And we found a whole different group of moderators who would do that. So the moderators, and we evaluate afterwards, the moderators are always very highly rated. Small group discussions are the most valuable, and people think nobody is offering their own opinion and distorting the process. As I mentioned, the advisory group has to vet the materials beforehand for balance and accuracy. So there's a lot of work. In fact, that Australian one, we had to go through 19 drafts before we could get agreement. So there's a lot of work on that. But the advisory group doesn't have to agree on what should be done, just that these are good arguments on that side and these are good arguments on the other side.
Transparency,
well, when we can, we use media, we televise, we use the web, we try to make the process and the results as transparent as possible. So I didn't state it, but I would agree with Graham that's an important criterion, because it has more purchase on public opinion if people can see it happening and they can understand, and we try to explain in a coherent way why the people came out the way they did. That speaks to the data, and then in later analyses we can look at the small group discussion.
How do you deal with the media, though, when the media prefers polarized discussion compared to deliberation?
Well, the media often does. But we find that if you have a deliberative poll that will produce results, they're interested in the results,
right?
Because there's drama in the results, because the results are unpredictable. They're interested in the human stories that come out of it. There's a book about the process that came out early on. It was called The Poll with a Human Face. Mm-hmm. So we're putting a human face on public opinion. But it's not like focus groups. It's systematically representative. So.
What about this issue about specificity of particular issues?
Yeah, you see, I think it just has to be clear. It could be big, like the options that will eventually be before this country. But in every case, there has to be a lot of work, not to get the people to make a technical judgment, but to get them to make a judgment about the competing values, the trade-offs. What are the values that will be served by doing this or doing that, by no Brexit, or, I mean, just pulling it out of the air as you did, no Brexit or Brexit or this deal, what are the, and we found, we did this project in California that you can see on the web that had immensely complicated issues about the government of California, the legislative process, the initiative system, the taxation. The public just did a fantastic job, not only of understanding it, but in weighing the trade-offs, and they came out to big changes of opinion about it. So, you know, it's quite possible. So it's not that it should be specific, it's that it should be clear, and that somebody should do the work to boil it down to explain the values that are impinged, that are at stake in whatever choices that are available.
Okay, great. And I think it is clear there's only three options, aren't there, right? So,
Well, who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. Titus down the front here.
Thank you. Titus Alexander, Democracy Matters. We're trying to persuade the government and parliament to do more deliberative democracy. Do you have any tips from your experience for what swings them behind it?
Great. And then there's two questions just up here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for such an interesting talk. Since I started facilitating public debates for a living, I've become acutely aware of the importance of structure, training, and rules to make sure underrepresented people feel confident coming forward, help people articulate an argument coherently, and to keep the discussion civil. And that's only for groups of 50 to 60 people at a time. What structure, training, and rules do you put in place when you are bringing together hundreds of people at a time?
Great. And then just behind you.
Thank you, Professor Fishkin, for this talk. It's amazing. I was going to ask about distortions as well, but seeing as we're at the RSA, I'll ask about creative practice within the public deliberation and citizens' juries. Sounds like the focus is very heavy on orality, and that's something innate to the format, like the oral and vocal practice.
I'm sorry, you said we're focused on what? Did you say morality?
Orality.
Orality, right.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you... Yeah, I work at UCL and at the mayor's office, and I was wondering if you have used creative methods that aren't so focused on voice in any of your previous cases.
Okay, tips. Well, look, we ended up with those 108 cases in 28 countries because somebody had a problem, somebody had an issue, and it seemed appropriate to consult the public. And just like the people those in Texas, they said, well, how are we, what's the best way to consult the public if the issue is important? So when we did this project for the Regione Lazio in Italy, which is the state where Rome is the capital, after we did it, and it was about the distribution of medical resources, the assessore came up to me and he said, you gave me cover to do the right thing. I'd been wanting to do that for years, but now I can say, inform public opinion, move this way, and that's how we did it. And so it's solving that kind of problem is one source of input. And but I think now there's another, in the sense that there's, as has been said tonight, a kind of legitimacy crisis. And the only way to deal with that legitimacy is to connect with the people. And if you connect with the people in some very superficial way, the public will see right through it. The mayor in Ulaanbaatar had been criticized for having a text message-based referendum on certain environmental issues, which if you had three cell phones, you could vote three times. And it was very... And he realized finally how superficial it was. And that's why he came to see me on his study tour in the U.S., because he wanted something more substantive and more scientifically representative. And that's how we launched... That's how we launched the thing in Mongolia, the whole adventure.
How do you facilitate with such big groups, and do you use non-voice ways of engaging people?
The model really hasn't changed. Even when it's online, you've got some software like the software that we were using where you can see everybody, and there's a queue with either a human moderator or maybe with this automated system we're experimenting with. So I think that a lot of the opinion changes have to do with people really understanding the viewpoint of other people. And so anonymous text allows people to flame and argue with each other. And so the voice is very useful. And the voice, we've done some just with voice, but we found the voice and the video even better for keeping everybody participating. I was astonished. We did one on immigration in the U.S., and not a single person dropped out for the whole day sitting in front of a computer screen. So they saw each other in their small groups in the plenary session. So so we use voice and video together, or we use voice in the small group. In a small group, when you see everybody, you're getting a lot of information from the other people involved. So we haven't experimented with anything else except in efforts at agenda setting, perhaps, to create an agenda for the issue to be chosen for the deliberation. Now, what was the...
That was about the voice.
Oh, yeah. The voice. Yeah, yeah. So, rules. So the scale, it's modular. So it's easy to scale it. So you just, in Mongolia, that was the biggest one we've done, although the one we're planning now in the U.S. is the same size, 700 deliberators, 50 small groups or whatever it will be. And so it's just modular. You just have more small groups. So how do we train them? We train the moderators. We have the process. We random assign the participants. We use random sampling to recruit the sample. And see, it's built upon the what everybody in public opinion research knows are the good methods. Probability sampling, there's an art and science of how you formulate questions in surveys, and when done properly, it works. One of my colleagues actually showed that in the U.S. presidential election, the very few probability sample based polls and the ones with high standards actually got all the results right. It's just there's so much pressure to have tiny response rates reported in the media immediately, various shortcut methods for things that are called polls that aren't really shouldn't be called polls. So the method is similar. We collaborate all over the world and try to instill standards. If anybody wants to think about doing one, contact us and we'll try to help you.
Brilliant. Well, Jim, thank you so much for your inspiring talk this evening. I'm afraid that's all we have time for now. I'm just picturing that Mongolian picture there, and it's inspiring to me, and the hope is that perhaps in the next year, 2 years, we'll be able to have a similar National Assembly, whether it's along Graham Allen's lines of on constitutional issues or even on any other issue that the public might want to choose. That's certainly the aspiration behind our campaign, that we would push deliberative democracy up the agenda so that we end up with a great photo like that, possibly not outside the Houses of Westminster, but somewhere. I want to say thank you to you all for your fantastic questions this evening. To tell you that Jim will be outside signing copies of his book if you'd like to get one of those, and that there's a drinks reception downstairs. If you haven't had a chance to ask your question or you want to talk a bit more about some of the things that we've been talking about this evening, then you'll be able to do that. But thank you all very much for coming along, and thank Jim once again for his inspiring talk. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.